The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. The first article for today is an article from Teen Vogue's OG History series titled, "The DC Punk Scene Relied on the Local Latinx Community." This was written by Mike Amesqua and was published December 31st, 2021. An old Presbyterian church hall located on a busy northwest intersection of Washington, D.C., occupies a special place in the histories of two youth movements of the 1980s. In the church's basement, known then as the Wilson Center, D.C.'s explosive punk and hardcore music scene found a home for performances by bands such as Minor Threat, State of Alert, The Faith, and more. It was also a community space for a large migration of youth fleeing political violence in El Salvador, who used it as a resource and a refuge. While the space accommodated these two groups, predominantly white punks who hailed from D.C. suburbs and semi-suburbs and refugees from war-torn Central America, they existed in the city under very different circumstances and socioeconomic conditions. At the Wilson Center, it was the punks who were the visitors, as the basement had for years been a space for Latinx immigrant autonomy, mutual aid, and youth self-expression. How this predominantly white youth subculture interacted with the process of Latinx neighborhood building and community making has often been left out of the story of DC's legendary punk and hardcore scene of the 1980s. In previous decades, the neighborhoods, Adams Morgan, Mount Pleasant, and Columbia Heights, surrounding the church had become anchor points for working class black and brown residents who were making do in redlined, disinvested areas. Yet, the relatively poor economic conditions of the area's immigrants, coupled with the city neglect, made these neighborhoods optimal spaces for suburban punks to enjoy loud music and violent slam dancing, something that was impossible in more upscale neighborhoods. It was here that DC's punk and hardcore scene found a home within community spaces created by and for Latinx immigrants. A barrio community center gave punk rockers a space to congregate and make unruly sounds, but more importantly, it lent some authenticity to the scene's ideals of all ages, music spaces, self-sufficient autonomy, and anti-corporate culture. In short, Latinx immigrants and refugees gave punks a stage for their own movement, a point which has been largely unacknowledged and forgotten to this day. Those who were around the scene 40 years ago recall that it was the pioneering all-black hardcore band, the Bad Brains, that organized the first show at the Wilson Center in 1981 with 13 bands. "This was a mind-blowing show for me," remembers Malcolm Riviera, a transplant from North Carolina who attended the show. He later organized shows there himself during the early 80s to showcase the youth-driven scene of fast, angry, and energetic bands. Almost overnight, the tiny scene ascended into a giant burst of multifaceted creativity that altered independent and underground music forever. But as important as it was for the DC scene to find any place where a racket would be tolerated, as local hardcore luminary Henry Rollins put it about those early years, punks rarely grappled with what it meant to borrow environments built by black and brown communities. Since the 1970s, several waves of teenage punks have found refuge in the minority enclaves of post-industrial America: neighborhoods, community centers, theaters, galleries, cafes, and restaurants that for many white punks have represented the anti-suburb, These were the make-do neighborhoods of urban America that were increasingly black, brown, and migrant. Punk scenes flowered in San Francisco and Los Angeles, where bands performed in Filipino and Chinese restaurants. Most of L.A.'s legendary punk bands made it a point to play in a Mexican-American community center in Boyle Heights. The Bad Brains of D.C. played in a public housing project. The New York's hardcore scene emerged on the streets of Puerto Rican and Dominican enclaves on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Native American centers, Japanese American cafes, and Central American social clubs were all recruited as makeshift venues for hardcore punk shows in which predominantly white youth from more affluent areas participated in the juxtaposition of fast, raging music performed in other people's urban communities. Long before DC punk rockers descended on Latinx community spaces, Latinx peoples were themselves making Adams Morgan and Mount Pleasant into areas of sanctuary, self-sufficiency, and do-it-yourself ingenuity. Throughout the 1970s, immigrants altered the business corridor to welcome shoppers in Spanish, carrying familiar products from Puerto Rico, Mexico, and South America. Sites that later became touchstones of the punk scene, such as the Co-op, Collective, Adams Morgan, and Ontario Theater, were surrounded by Latinx placemaking. The Ontario Theater became an important site of community organizing in the fight to maintain the working class and Latinx character of the area amid gentrification. Years before the Wilson Center set the stage for legendary hardcore shows by the likes of Minor Threat, Government Issue, and The Faith, the building had become a headquarters for an influential Latin American left of political exiles, immigrant workers, survivors of fascist governments, and international solidarity activists. As early as the mid-1960s, Latinx community leaders turned El Centro Wilson into a base for community action, organizing rallies and protests on a range of issues, including the immigrant workers' rights and anti-discrimination campaigns in city hiring. By the 1970s, a young Afro-Latino from Panama, Arturo Griffiths, became the director of the Wilson Center. During the decade, the basement buzzed with DIY activities, several mutual assistance organizations were founded, a community newspaper that covered issues ignored by mainstream papers, an employment center, and a free clinic. Joining Griffiths was an immigrant from Bolivia, Carlos Arian, who worked in an art space in the basement called Centro de Arte, which hosted artist workshops for youth, theater, and music performances, and was founded by young Chilean leftists who had escaped the Augusto Pinochet regime. In the late 1970s and early 80s, the existing Latinx community was renewed by the arrival of thousands of young Central American migrants fleeing political violence created by the authoritarian regimes, and they were supported by the U.S. government. This time, the Wilson Center became a center point for grassroots organizing against U.S. foreign policy that was upending the lives of millions of Salvadorian, Nicaraguans, and Guatemalans. The biggest groups were Salvadorians, many of whom were young, who settled in the area and lived as undocumented immigrants. A hearing on this refugee crisis before members of Congress placed the population in just D.C. at that estimated 80,000 people. The lives of Latinx immigrants were hardly on the minds of teenage punk rockers attending a show at the Wilson Center, but the infrastructure Central Americans had created and the conditions they sought to change were laid bare as a desirable stage for local hardcore music to thrive and gain legitimacy nationwide. The punks saw the Wilson Center as a perfect setting for shows, a big basement with a stage and plenty of room for slam dancing. From the point of view of punks, the perception of danger in the surrounding community only added to the romance of violence associated with the scene. Perhaps ironically, for local Latinx youth who lived in the area, the Wilson Center was a safe haven from gang violence and other Civil War trauma that haunted Central American teenagers who used the basement as an after-school drop-in center for teens. The Wilson Center of the 1980s became a monument to resisting the politics that ascended with Reagan in the 80s. And this was what the punks in the community had in common. As Cynthia Connolly, a longtime participant in the DC hardcore scene and one of the first chroniclers put in her book, Banned in DC, Photos and Anecdotes from the DC Punk Underground. Looking back, I realize that the election of an ultra-conservative president was a catalyst for the rise of the American punk movement because our values were at opposite ends of the spectrum. Still, at the time, few in the scene acknowledged that their ability to creatively express themselves against Reagan's vision of America was made more possible by the makeshift sanctuary spaces built by Central American refugees and other marginalized communities, the very people the Reagan administration was attacking, displacing, and criminalizing. By 1985, the DC hardcore scene had moved toward a more introspective and melodic sound, represented by bands such as Rites of Spring and Embrace. But the Wilson Center remained a familiar venue for independent music and simultaneously the center of Latinx immigrant political power. These were critical years in the struggle to secure legal protections for Central American refugees, who were not recognized as such under U.S. immigration law. Immigration activists enlisted the building into the national network of the sanctuary movement, hosting teach-ins and circulating communiques to publicize Reagan's relentless attack on Central Americans. A big piece is missing from the stories told about punk and hardcore in the 1980s. Primarily, the marginalized spaces and communities in urban America gave a stage to the predominantly white subculture, allowing it to thrive and practice its ideals of youth liberation, mutual aid, and creativity in opposition to corporations and mainstream America. Another missing piece is that those same marginalized communities were stakeholders with similar practices as punks, but with perhaps bigger implications. Punk needed these communities, Martin Sorondegai, lead singer of seminal hardcore punk bands Los Cruos and Limp Wrist, told me recently. You can't be underground in the suburbs. In recent years, libraries and universities have started collecting punk archives in an effort to document this distinct form of youth culture. Flyers and zines created by teens and oral histories with ex-punks can now be found at institutions such as the University of Maryland and the DC Public Library. These sources might one day help rewrite DC punk's story, or just reaffirm the dominant narrative, upholding the exceptionalism of creativity, angry teen punks, while overlooking the refuge that a community of young refugees gave them. The next article is titled, Sha'Carri Richardson to Appear in New Short Documentary, Sub 11 Seconds. The film was executive produced by Virgil Abloh. This is written by Brittany McNamara and was published January 19th, 2022. Sha'Carri Richardson's fame exploded ahead of the 2020 Olympics. The track star, with her bold orange hair, was known for her record-breaking speed, declaring in a post-race interview that she wanted the world to know that she is that girl. When marijuana use disqualified her from competing at the Games, fans and supporters were heartbroken, not just because we couldn't watch her prowess on the track, but because she is that girl, the one everyone was rooting for. Now, Sha'Carri will tell her story in a new short film that explores time, both how it was on her side and against her. The film called Sub 11 Seconds, likely referencing her record-breaking 100-meter speed, will premiere at the 2022 Sundance Film Festival. Directed by Bafik, with executive producer Virgil Abloh, Sha'Carri tweeted the trailer to the film on January 18th. On the Sundance website, the film is described as a rumination on time, loss, and hope, featuring a poetic imagining of Sha'Carri's quest to reach the Olympic Games. Time is my blessing and my curse, Sha'Carri says in the trailer. On the track, I've been blessed to run fast. Off the track, time has cheated me. You don't know when something or someone will be taken from you. Sha'Carri was disqualified from the Olympics after testing positive for marijuana use, which she said she used to cope with emotional pain. After the positive test, Sha'Carri appeared on Today and said she learned of her biological mother's death from a news reporter, which sent her into an emotional panic. That, she said, led her to use marijuana to cope. We all have our different struggles, she said at the time, but to put on a face, to have to go in front of the world and put on a face and hide my pain, like, who are you? Who am I to tell you how to cope when you're dealing with a pain or you're dealing with a struggle you've never experienced before? I apologize for the fact that I didn't know how to control my emotions or deal with my emotions during that time, she continued. Don't judge me. I'm human. I just happen to run a little faster. Sundance Film Festival runs from January 20th to January 30th. The next article is titled, What the New American Girl Doll Means for Asian Representation. This is by Melissa Shang and was published January 11th, 2022. Every year, American Girl releases a new doll with an individual story of tackling a modern-day challenge, from reviving her school's art department to conserving wildlife. The motive of this line, called American Girl's Girl of the Year, is to tell stories that are relevant to young girls today. This year's Girl of the Year doll, Corinne Tan, is the first of Chinese descent. For Chinese American girls like me, Corinne is much more than just a doll. I started collecting American Girl dolls when I was 7 years old, and for 6 years of my life, I was infatuated with them. I read all the books and watched all the movies, and every Christmas, I begged my parents to buy me that year's Girl of the Year. Still, as the daughter of first-generation immigrants from China, I never truly saw myself in any of these contemporary dolls or their stories. None of them had my black hair and almond-shaped eyes. None of them ate the braised pork belly and sticky rice balls of my culture. All of them could see the latest movie and go shopping with their friends without fear of being told to go back to their country. These Girl of the Year dolls are made to reflect modern experiences, but none told a story similar to mine. When the experiences of the characters I loved were vastly different from mine, I started to wonder whether I could really consider myself an American girl. Then came Corinne, who lives in Aspen, Colorado, with her younger sister, Gwen, and loves to ski, celebrated her Chinese heritage, and trained her new puppy to be a search and rescue dog. She has long black hair with blue highlights and several exclusive features, including her hairstyle, skin tone, and eyes. As a Chinese American girl, I deeply identify with her. I could not be more excited to finally be properly represented. American Girl has previously released other Asian American dolls, but they have either not been a main character or they've had their heritage essentially erased. The Chinese American doll Ivy Ling was a companion to the white historical character Julia Albright. The biracial Japanese American doll Jess McConnell was the 2006 Girl of the Year, but both sides of her family had lived in the United States for several generations. Corinne is the first Girl of the Year to have her Asian American heritage be integral to her identity. At just 10 years old, I started fighting for American Girl to have better representation. While the company had produced Black, Latinx, Native, and other dolls representative of young people across America, there were notable exclusions. I was born with Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, a form of muscular dystrophy, and in 2014, I started a viral petition for American Girl to release a doll with a disability. In 2020, American Girl released their first doll with a visible disability, Girl of the Year Joss Kendrick, who is hard of hearing. While I was thrilled to finally see the disability community represented in my childhood favorite doll company, I wasn't sure whether Joss was only released to lessen public demand for American Girl to be more diverse, or whether the brand would continue to promote diversity. Fortunately, the release of Corinne seems to be inspired by American Girl's mounting effort toward more complete representation. Jamie Sigelman, the general manager of American Girl, told Yahoo Life, "It's important for kids to see themselves in our storytelling, or to learn about a life or culture that may be different from their own, to help build empathy, courage, and conviction." Siegelman's words were echoed by Wendy Wan Long Shang, author of Corinne's stories, Corinne and Corinne to the Rescue, who said, "I think when readers feel seen, they realize that they matter and their experiences matter, and that they are meant to be the stars of their own stories." An element of Corinne's story that resonates with many Asian Americans is her interracial family. Corinne grew up living with her Chinese American parents, so when her mom remarries to her white stepdad, Arnie, her definition of family shifts. Eventually, she learns that no matter how much her family seems to change, love will keep them together. In an interview, 18-year-old Cassie Zimmerman tells me, "As a Chinese adoptee in a white family, the aspects of Corinne experiencing what it's like to be a part of an interracial family intrigued me. I have rarely seen this kind of cultural blending within families in the media, and the fact that I can relate makes me all the more ecstatic for the doll's release and what her story can be for other girls who can identify with her." The release of Corinne comes after 2 years of rising anti-Asian sentiment, much of it stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. Newly corrected data released by the FBI in October 2021 shows that anti-Asian hate crimes increased more than 73% in 2020. According to a 2021 survey conducted by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, 1 in 4 Asian households feared that they would be attacked or threatened because of their race. Speaking out against racism is another important element of Corinne's story. When a boy tells her that she has Kung Flu, a derogatory reference to COVID-19, she initially doesn't know how to respond. However, after seeing her mom confront a man who made a racist joke, she's inspired to stand up for herself. Not only does Corinne's story illustrate the impact that racist comments can have, but it also teaches Asian American girls that they can and should defend themselves against such comments. To reinforce Corinne's message of anti-racism, American Girl is partnering with AAPI Youth Rising, a youth-led organization that raises awareness about the rise in xenophobia against Asian American and Pacific Islanders. Asian American Girl is donating $25,000 to the organization's 1-180 pledge, which asks educators to teach at least one day of AAPI history and culture during the school year. The release of Corinne is an incredibly important step towards better Asian American representation and will enable thousands of young Asian American girls to, upon opening their birthday or holiday gifts this year, find that they finally have a doll who is just like them. For me and so many other Asian American girls out there, thank you, American Girl. And the last one briefly is about the Omicron variant impacting young people's mental health. This is by Fortessa Latifi, published January 21, 2022. Ilias, age 14, lost both of his grandfathers to COVID on the same day in April of 2021. Even if the virus eventually passes and people can safely leave face masks and social distancing in the past, his life is changed forever. "I don't think I feel the sense of safety again," he said. "It's probably not going to be the same." COVID has shattered a sense of safety for so many people. Not only the loved ones of more than 850,000 Americans who have been lost to the virus, but those whose lives have been turned upside down by our rapidly changing world. Perhaps nowhere has this uncertainty been more acute than in adolescence, a time meant for adventure, growth, and development, which has been distorted beyond recognition by COVID. Ilias has been making plans, being vaccinated, maybe he could start to hang out with his friends again, but then the latest surge hit and that didn't feel safe anymore. He remembers that what he was like before COVID changed both the world and his world. A motivated kid who liked to play basketball, practice each week, but he hasn't found his way back there after the losses that reshaped him. Benjamin Miller, PsyD, a psychologist with Well-Being Trust, says the pandemic has had a profound impact on social connection for young people who are at a critical age for such connection. They want it, they need it, and desire it, but they may not have the chance to create those bonds that are so needed, Miller says. And coping with the extreme uncertainty of the world could change the way young people develop. What scares me the most is that these kids will develop to be constantly worried about the next shoe that will drop. Always being in fight or flight changes their brain development. I want them to know how to relax and know the world is not always trying to come at you. Now there's constant uncertainty about what comes next. For many people, that uncertainty extends to whether or not they're going to be back in Zoom school as the Omicron variant rages. Elizabeth, a 17-year-old senior in high school, says she struggled with mental health and body dysmorphia while doing online school. It wasn't clear to her until she went back, she says, how important that community is to her. Now she worries the latest surge will close schools again. "It feels like we're living in the precipice of something. It's never ending. We don't know if we should let our guard down." All right, we've come to the end of today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. You can visit our website after this episode, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.